This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with a friend if you find it of interest. Today, I have a great conversation for you with Matt Taibbi. He is an award-winning reporter and author. He hosts the America This Week podcast with novelist Walter Kerm. I subscribe to it, and I hope that you will as well. And you can find his writing primarily at Racket News, which is at racket.news. It's a Substack that he's started and run for a while now. Matt is someone who has been through the journalistic gamut in so many different capacities. Rolling Stone, his work, you know, covering the financial crisis and the Fed. Obviously, his past work in Russia, which is something that I think some of you are probably familiar with. But then he was also someone who gained a lot of new prominence over the past couple of months, given his coverage of the Twitter files, one that allowed him access to all sorts of different material that was hidden behind the scenes, you know, in Twitter during the course of their decision-making processes around the 2016 election and the 2020 election, that he has been able to roll out in front of audiences that, you know, I think are very much responding to the in-depth reporting that he's done. I think that Matt Taibbi is one of the most interesting writers and journalists working today, and I hope that you find our conversation of interest. Matt Taibbi, coming up next.
It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Matt Taibbi, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you about a couple of things, but first off, I want to ask you this sort of overall question about your career. You have gone through, I think, one of the more interesting story arcs in terms of the people who love you and the people who hate you of really any writer who I feel like I've been reading over the last 20 years. It's pretty amazing from the outside. How do you feel about it yourself?
That's an interesting question. I actually have always believed that any reporter who imagines that they're going to have friends and keep them through their whole careers is probably either delusional or not planning on doing the job correctly. I look at people who are either models or mentors of mine, you know, like Cy Hirsch. And, I think about what happened with them. And I always believe that a primary characteristic of any reporter who's trying to do this job correctly is that is a willingness to offend your own audience and people within the business. Unfortunately, that usually has the consequence of getting you either fired or bounced out of the business, but a unique characteristic of the current media landscape is that you get to still have a career and independently, and that's kind of a neat thing. So I don't worry about it too much. It was a little unsettling at points, but I think that's just how it goes, frankly.
What seed of knowledge that you had do you credit for the fact that you were attuned much earlier even than skeptics on the right to the nature of the Russiagate hoax?
I lived in Russia for 11 years, beginning in the early 90s. I'm old enough to have gone to college in the Soviet Union. I was in Russia when Vladimir Putin came to power. Putin actually closed down my old newspaper, The Exile. So I knew a fair amount about Russian politics. I had met people whom I knew were Russian intelligence in the course of my work, and probably people who were Russian intelligence, but I wasn't aware of it. So I had a pretty fair idea of how they operate, and just the story was so outlandish and so unlikely that I thought it was absurd from the start. And it also just didn't pass the smell test. I think early on when I was looking at the first reports about this, the first thing that struck me is that a lot of the sourcing was similar to the early WMD stories, where there were a lot of anonymous official sources, and we just couldn't check the work. You know, it's like science. If you can't reproduce the experiment in a lab, you can't do the story. And then there was the thing that happened, you know, when I published a couple of very mild articles about this, sort of suggesting that people be careful, there was this overwhelming condemnation, and that was another red flag. So, yeah, I think all those things were factors.
You know, one of the things that I think that really exposed was how much Americans' faith in the United States intelligence services was, especially on the right, misplaced. That somehow, because they, you know, didn't take the right lessons away from the WMD experience, or because they were kind of insulated from it to varying degrees, they didn't have that kind of skepticism that's very healthy and needed. My question is, do you think that that's something that exists now in a healthy way, meaning that there's actually going to be something that can be done about it? Or is this an incredible problem that's so overwhelming that you can't just actually go in there and reform the intelligence services in ways that actually have them do their jobs to the function that, you know, that most U.S. citizens would like to see them do?
That's a great question. I think I definitely met people in the course of trying to unravel this story on the right who were, you know, conservative politicians who seemed to me were having kind of a genuine come to Jesus moment about programs like the FISA Enhancement Act, about the tendency of the FBI to, you know, submit misleading answers even to congressional officials or in public. I think there were a lot of politicians who were genuinely surprised at the degree to which they were willing to dissemble and deceive in public. And that's been reflected in what seems to me a very aggressive and appropriate response by the Republican Party in trying to investigate some of these abuses. Which is useful to contrast with what happened after the Snowden disclosures and after WMD and after some of the WikiLeaks things that came out. The Democratic Party politicians made some noise about looking in those directions, but they never really followed through. So I think there is something to be done about it. There are mechanisms that you can use to fix these problems, and it looks like there are people who really want to try, so I'm hopeful.
I mean, to me, the FBI has so much, in particular, overstepped any kind of boundaries in terms of its behavior. You know, you look at the situation, you sort of say, looking back at the decisions that were made post 9/11 about the kind of collaborative methods, reforms, the creation of DHS, and everything else that was allowed there, you know, it certainly seems like something where this was used in a way that was never, you know, certainly I'm sure there were some people who wanted it to work this way, but for your average conservative politician, that was not what they intended. You know, they wanted to keep America safe. They were told that this was a way to keep America safe, and they went down this path. How do you unspool that? You know, if you actually have a new administration in town that really wanted to, wind back the clock and basically say, you know, hey, we don't need to have these institutions so integrated to such a degree that they can kind of tell lies and then approve of other people's lies within the system in ways that the politicians are none the wiser to, unless they go like the deep dive Chuck Grassley, you know, Jim Jordan route and figure things out. Yeah. What's the way to do that? How do we unspool that in a way that's responsible?
Well, first of all, I think you've got the chronology there correct. You know, after 9/11, I think there was a widespread belief, not just among conservative politicians, but among a lot of, you know, sort of centrist Democrats, who are the majority of Democrats now, overwhelmingly, that all of these agencies needed to be given vastly enhanced powers. And they rolled back reforms that had been made that I think were very necessary after the Church Committee hearings in the 70s, including things like requiring the FBI to have some kind of predicate before they investigate somebody. You know, once upon a time, the FBI actually had to have a reason, and they had to be pursuing a case to be looking at you. And now the FBI is essentially a counterintelligence operation that spends a lot of its time and resources just gathering information about people, and the work doesn't go towards any kind of prosecution. That's completely new in American society since the Hoover days.
But yeah, so the one of the things you just mentioned, politician naivete, and I think that that leads us to, you know, something that you had to confront personally, you know, in front of Congress, which is the level of naivete that they have about the way that our intelligence services and our political class works hand in glove with big tech to do things that they would not be able to do themselves. Something that you have really exposed over the last, you know, not just months, but years, I would say, in terms of your reporting, even before the Twitter files, it was something you were paying attention to. And I know that it's something that, you know, for a lot of Americans, it just kind of, it seems like just a sea of unintelligible stuff getting thrown at them. You know, just like, oh, these big tech, you know, they're doing bad things. You know, I have that general suspicion. How do you elucidate that in a way that even someone as dumb and naive as a member of Congress can understand?
That's a great question. I love the way you put that. Yeah, it's tough, right? Because one of the things that you saw, even in that hearing with Schellenberger, Michael Schellenberger and me, and it's funny, if you go back and watch that performance, you can see that there are numerous moments where Michael and I kind of look at each other with smiles on our faces, almost like an astonishment, because as spectators, it was so amazing to watch these people who had been elected to Congress, who appeared not to know, like, what was in the First Amendment, for instance, you know, things that should be fairly basic. But, you know, I think this is a consistent theme of what's happened in the last 5 to 10 years. One of the first things that we found in the Twitter files was an exchange between Vijay Gadde, who was essentially the executive running Twitter during the 2020 election, and the politician, the Democratic politician, Ro Khanna, who was trying to explain to her why it was bad for them to suppress the New York Post's Hunter Biden expose. And it was like she was hearing what prior restraint and, you know, preemptive censorship, like, what, for the first time, like, those concepts had never entered her head. Like, she didn't even know the parameters of that discussion. And I think that's increasingly common. Like, there are people in Congress who don't know that America historically does not have a harm standard for speech, or that the existing law has a very high bar, you know, incitement to imminent lawless action. Like, they don't even know what the law is. So how do you argue with people who are coming from this place where they don't know anything about America's traditions, which, by the way, are deeply rooted in valuing freedom of speech, freedom of expression? It's the core idea of the whole American experiment, and they don't know it. So it's terrifying, I think.
You know, the thing that is really disturbing to me is that I remember I was an aide on Capitol Hill briefly for about 2 years to Texas Senator John Cornyn back in the 2000s. And I was a speechwriter, and And that overlapped with kind of the conversation that Ted Stevens had about the internet being a series of tubes. And I know that it's like, RIP Ted Stevens, by the way, another guy who was completely ramrodded by the FBI side of things and only cleared, late. But one of the things that is funny to me is I feel like series of tubes is more accurate than what most of these current members of Congress understand about the way the internet works.
That's probably true. Yes.
It makes me infuriated, but also, I mean, I'm in my 40s, you're a little older than me, but it's like at some point, can't we shift to a generation of politicians who understand on a basic level how these things work and aren't stuck in the 1940s in terms of their understandings of technology? And how can you even begin to explain some of the things that you were just talking about in the internet context to someone who basically, I know the difference in my own life between being an elder millennial who grew up without social media and my little sister who grew, who was 10 years younger than me, who grew up with social media, and we're in the same generation. So I can't even imagine, have you had conversations with some of these politicians where you've walked them through what's going on, behind the scenes? Have they been receptive? Have they heard what you've and connected with you on these points, or is it still kind of just like a blank face stare?
Well, I mean, I had exchanges with the Democrats only really in the public hearing. There was that one incredible moment where Sylvia Garcia, the representative, I think she's from Texas, is it the 29th? She was asking me about a Twitter file thread that I had posted that morning before the hearing, and it was abundantly clear in the exchange that she had no idea what Twitter was. She thought it was some kind of editorial body that I had submitted an article to for review. And then you can see in the hearing that there's an aide who's leaning over to her and basically telling her, he just put something on there, like they didn't review it. That's kind of what we're dealing with, is people who don't know even the basics of what it is to post something, or what the difference is between a company that is actually giving a human review to material or just automatically uploading it. They don't know those differences. And so if you worked on the Hill, when there's a technical gap in knowledge, when there's a gap in technical knowledge, members tend to defer to interests who can explain it to them. Mm-hmm. And the public doesn't have a lobby that's able to do that, really. So they rely very, very heavily on the companies to tell them what's up. And that's why this system has gotten, I think, very corrupted.
So let's talk a little bit about the perspective that you have on media today. You are friends with, and you have very interesting conversations with, Walter Kern, who has, for his sins, I guess, decided to launch a newspaper. Mm-hmm. how quaint. But I also think that there's something interesting about that, which is to say, we're living through a period in which there's been an enormous amount of disruption in the media landscape. I don't know what your opinions are, or if you read the Ben Smith book, or if you have any kind of thoughts on the landscape that we've kind of gone through. But I remember, 10 years ago, you look back to 2012 and BuzzFeed and the work that Andrew Kaczynski was doing for them, that was assumed to be kind of the way of the future. These, massive sites would get, they would make their money, with cat pics, and then they would sponsor, these other things. Now we're in a completely different landscape in so many ways. As you mentioned, you have the ability to stand up something as an individual or as a group of individuals so much more easily than I think you could before. It's kind of a return in many ways to the the newsletter concept, which has been around forever, and the you know, basically a more powerful version of the blogging model. I'm just curious what your perspective is on the most interesting trends when it comes to online writing, because you've been part of it at kind of every iteration of its existence in one way or another.
I love that question. I love this topic. I think about it a lot. Walter's newspaper is very interesting to me. He and I both belong to, I think, a dying breed in the business, which involves people who were involved with journalism back when you needed to know more than just creating the content and hitting send. I came into the business by way of alternative newspapers, and I had to physically do every part of the operation, from design to making those old plates that they used to run off the newspapers at the printing press, to, in some cases, physically distributing papers. I had my own distribution run with a pickup truck that I used to do.
You've seen Liberty Valance, founder, editor, publisher, and I also sweep up the place.
Exactly, which, by the way, is the you know, that's the model that American media had for a long time. It was like a working class thing for ages, where the printer was really also the journalist for
can I interrupt for just a second? You just said something key, which is working class. Mm-hmm. And the thing that seems to me to have been changed, and I don't know exactly the, you know, the point that you would select to change it, but being a journalist, being a reporter, was a working class profession for a very, very long time here in America. And at some point it became this elite sort of you know, place for people to flow into, and I think that that had profound and negative effects on the way that the work is done. I don't know if you agree, but it just...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a great line or great passage in Michael Herr's book, Walter Winchell, or I think it's just called Winchell, where he's describing the famous radio broadcaster Walter Winchell. And this is back in the 30s or 40s or whenever it was, when being a journalist was not an honorable profession for a person of the upper class. And somebody asks him if he's in the media, and he says, yeah, but don't tell anybody. My mother still thinks I'm a piano player in a whorehouse. and that was kind of how people thought of journalists once upon a time. They were, you know, somewhere around the level of like a plumber, you know. The people who worked in the profession were not upscale rich people. That mm-hmm. was just not the case for a long time. And then I think there was a big change, and this comes from me personally observing, because my father went into the business when it was still relatively a middle class to working class profession, and then he watched these changes. It became, I think, sexy after All the President's Men. And then a lot of kids who were more like me, who went to, you know, upscale liberal arts schools, started to flow into the business. And then by the time I came in, it was almost exclusively Ivy League grads and people of that ilk. And the problem, as you identify, is that these people are the same people they're supposed to be covering. Socially, they come from the same set.
Yeah,
they do not have this natural anti-establishment bent that used to be built into the business.
You know what else they have, and this is the thing that like just sticks out to me. They have the same agents.
Well, that's true. Yes.
You know,
yes.
Like, this is one of the things that Ethan Strauss is so good about pointing out, is, you know, that often an NBA player will have the same representative or a representative in the same house as the ESPN personality who's assigned to be covering them. That creates problems. Like, that's not a good thing.
It sure does. And then, you know, think about all the bizarre ethical machinations that could be going on backstage. You know, Reporter X is writing a book about Senator Y, and Senator Y wants to publish a book with that same label. It starts to get weird really fast. And that's even before you get into the social ramifications of all this.
I was at the UTA White House Correspondents Dinner Party. I don't go to the dinner because I hate it and I wish that it would disappear. But the that is, you know, just sort of, it's Doug Emhoff talking to the entire crew from CNN, talking to, you know, this person from Fox and this person from MSNBC, and then you turn on the TV and you see, you know, five different ex-FBI or CIA or DOJ people, you know, all on camera together alongside someone who's also, you know, represented by them as the host, you know, represented by the same agency as the host. And it's like, wait a minute, this is, I mean, come on, this is taking incest to new levels. So, it's just, I find it to be really a problem. And it's one of the reasons why I think journalism has really suffered so much in America, is because, you know, alongside kind of the social media landscape, the ad landscape, you know, leaving local media to die in a ditch, you know, you end up with these people who basically go straight from Harvard, straight from Princeton to working for, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post. And they don't ever have that experience of, you know, trying to buttonhole a state rep, you know, in a situation where they need an answer for something on a story. And that leaves all those stories to be picked up by these entities online that have, I think, a lot of hardworking people, but also don't necessarily have the trust level that, mm-hmm. that some of these other, you know, big places do.
Yeah. And also they've created a kind of new revolving door, right, where people yeah. go from Harvard to the New York Times, and then maybe from the New York Times to becoming aides and on the Hill, and then maybe from that they go into the intelligence services or vice versa. Certainly the other route is now well established, mm-hmm. where people, you know, go to work in intelligence or law enforcement, and now they are pouring into media in enormous numbers and replacing and supplanting jobs that once belonged to journalists. Now, why is that a problem? I mean, I think you would think it would be obvious. You know, people who work in intelligence, they are trained to deceive. That is their, you know, entire modus operandi. And they do it, you know, many times for patriotic reasons, or what they think are patriotic reasons. But they don't have any conception of going for the truth no matter who it hurts. That's not mm-hmm. that's not their objective. Also, the other thing just quickly about that is the media derives all of its power from the perception of separateness from everything else. Like, in order to be scary, the press has to be this unruly, ungoverned thing that exists outside of government and, you know, throws a scare into politicians. And they can't be that if there's this web of interlocking relationships, and that's the thing that really troubles me, just on the level of people not understanding where their influence comes. Like, you lose your influence once people perceive you to be, you know, sitting in the lap of Congress or the White House or whatever it is. Like, why would you bother listening to a journalist in that case?
Yeah, I mean, they might as well walk around like a NASCAR driver with Northrop right? Grumman, you know, just right across their chest.
Exactly. Yeah.
So just to, one more question on the media landscape thing. We've seen, you and I have kind of seen the departure, sadly, you know, sometimes via death, sometimes via, you know, the nature of the industry, of a lot of contrarian voices, it feels like. There used to be, I felt, like the section of the media landscape where you didn't necessarily know what they were going to say about something. You didn't necessarily know what position they would take on the news of the day. Obviously, Christopher Hitchens was one of these, but I would actually argue that Andrew Breitbart was one of them, too. It's mm-hmm. somebody who, you know, would often zig where you might expect them to zag. And, you know, it makes me, you know, depressed to see the kind of landscape that has, I feel like, very completely predictable, you know, people and headlines. You know what they're going to say before you click on the piece. And when you, and you know, it's very rare that you have somebody who has some kind of contrarian bent to it. I would talk about this as a problem that is symbolized by The Atlantic and its descent into what it has become. But I feel like, I mean, it's obviously bigger than them, but I just think that they, that there was a place where you used to have interesting ideas and now that's, it's one in a million. What can be done to re-inject some contrarian ethos, some, you know, some motivation to flip off the entire Bill Maher audience, you know, to the way that people are approaching their jobs in media today? Because it seems like something very important is lost if we don't have that.
Well, first of all, on The Atlantic, I would rather have my teeth pulled out one by one than voluntarily read that publication from beginning to end. It is so unreadable.
So terrible. It's so bad.
It's astonishing. You know, like, it's not just...
I view the last interesting thing they did was that cover story that got him canceled by Jesse Singel, you know, like whatever that was 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And it's just been downhill ever since. And, anyway, but continue.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You mentioned my co-host Walter Hearn, right? Not long ago, you know, he was the editor at Spy Magazine. And once upon a time, Spy Magazine was emblematic of what people thought of magazine writers, which is that secretly they're very witty people who have very funny observations that they would love to share with you, you know, if they only got the chance. And that is not true anymore. The people who work in media are just not funny people anymore. They have no sense of humor, and it comes through in the absolutely unreadable prose that they crank out in enormous volumes. I think The Atlantic is the kind of supreme example of just unreadability in media now. But the predictability thing you talk about is a problem. I think its roots begin with the financial shape of the business, where most organizations make their money by identifying a demographic and just kind of feeding it stuff that, you know, they know that the readers and audiences will like. So there's a penalty that you pay for being surprising, which they're not willing to pay. I think that's actually a little misguided, that you need to kind of, you know, be a little bit unpredictable in order to keep the respect of your own audiences, but also, you know, to keep your own respect, right?
Yeah.
And that's what makes media interesting, or should make media interesting. It's funny, and not to go on about this, but for a very brief period of time, I worked in the organization that became The Intercept. At the time, I was supposed to be at First Look Media, working to create a satirical site. And I had arguments about the BuzzFeed phenomenon you talked about, where the hot takes, where everybody thought it could be automated, and that things like Upworthy were the secret to media, because, you know, algorithms would be able to identify what people like the most, and then we could just crank it out. And I argued that no, actually, what's going to be important in the future is that there's going to be so much automated crap that being identifiably human is what's going to have value.
Yes.
And that in order to do that, a key thing is to be funny, to be different, and be unpredictable. And they totally rejected that idea, and that's one of the reasons I never worked there. But I still think that's true.
Your inspiring defense of humanity was graded as a D-minus.
Exactly.
on the algorithmic scale. So the thing that I find so disturbing about this is that it just is not, it's not conducive to have a situation where all of our different columnists and editorial people are basically speaking from the same sheet over and over and over again. This is the column that you have written 500 times. And I do not mean that to be a slight against my friend George Will, but it is one of these things where I think that, you know, that there's just so much repetitiveness to this that you don't really get something new. And then, but then also I think that that problem has creeped over into the other areas of media where you just have basically 12 people at 12 different sites writing the same piece, you know, based off of often the same piece of misinformation that they're, you know, using to kind of hook things to. And the thing that I find, you know, sort of disturbing about this is that I don't see the level of interest and investment in creating actual journalism that we ought to see. And Substack's great. I know you love Substack. I love Substack. We all, you know, love the ability to sort of be able to monetize our work. But there has to be something bigger than this. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just have a situation where the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all of these legacy media institutions are churning out the same sort of misinformation over and over again on a daily basis, and there isn't something that rises up and challenges that on a greater scale, on the, you know, with the capacity to produce, you know, feature pieces that have, you know, three bylines and you know, and the investment of, you know, years of work and labor, and obviously, you know, this is going to be on Fox. I you know, as a Fox contributor, you know, I love the work that we do, but very few people ever point out that, like, we're just one place. You know, like there's a limitation to this. We need something more. Is there a capability to turn Substack or to turn the, you know, the various entities that have been grown up by you, by Michael, and by others, you know, into something that has a little bit more scale to it?
Yeah, I've believed that if somebody with a lot of money were to come along and create something, you know, that I called like Neither Side News, or you know, with some kind of wide scale effort to try to create a new sort of news model that was more fact based and less ideological, I think it would do well. The problem is the formula is a little elusive right now. How do you monetize it? I'm not really sure. That's a mystery that nobody solved. Substack hasn't solved it. When I worked at Rolling Stone, you know, back kind of in one of its heydays, they would tell me, hey, go out and investigate this for 9 weeks and then come back with 6,000 words. And who can afford to do that now? You have to be creating content constantly in order to pay for it, right?
You anticipated my next question. So when I went to college in 1999, I wanted to be a writer for National Geographic. I wanted to
be when I was a kid. That's interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to be the guy who they send to a place for 3-4 months and figures everything out about that place and comes back and writes 8,000 words and that's the thing. And then I do the next place, you know, and that's what my dream was. That job doesn't exist, or at least if it does, I'm unfamiliar with it. And you know, like so many people at my age range, 9/11 sort of disrupted a lot of things and changed paths and that kind of stuff. You were at Rolling Stone during one of its heydays. I'm so jealous of that. I just think it's an incredibly cool thing. And I mean that really, like it really was cool. People should go back and read it and actually appreciate it for what it was. Is there any way to get back to that? Is there any way to restore that? I mean, do we just have to find some, you know, ludicrous billionaire who wants to do something very silly and lose a lot of money? Is that the only way?
I don't know. I just think it might be something that involves new forms of media. Maybe it's more documentary style stuff. There's a lot of documentary work that's going on right now. I think it's really interesting. I'm not sure how it makes money because that's not the space that I operate in, but you're absolutely right. The you know, the type of work that you were talking about, which I did for, you know, 15, 20 years, that person doesn't really exist in media now. Journalists are, generally speaking, they're like professional test crammers, right? We enter a subject, we don't know anything, and then we're supposed to emerge at the end more or less experts on how things work. And you can do that overnight if it's a simple story, if there's only three or four points of fact that you have to master in order to do the story. But there's no way anybody can go in and learn, for instance, how the Pentagon budget is constructed in 24 hours. That it takes much longer than that, right? So in the absence of that kind of system, we're going to have all sorts of topics that are not going to be in popular media. Like, how does the Fed work? How does money creation work? Does anybody know? Like, most people don't. And that's the major, major problem, is that you're creating audiences who have no knowledge base.
Just to express the level of laziness that some of these folks have, that I wrote a magazine profile for The Spectator of Mark Wayne Mullen, the senator from Oklahoma, who's an interesting character for a number of reasons. But he hadn't had kind of any kind of I'm not really into like the politician profile, but no one had profiled him. Like, no one on the national level had done it. And I went down to where he lives in Stillwell, Oklahoma, which is one of the poorest counties in the entire United States. And when I went down there, it was just very funny because, you know, they were like, well, all the journalist needs to do is to like come here. Right. and it's like none of them have come here. Right. So it's like, and so you spend 2 days there and you go to the strawberry festival and the late night rodeo, and you meet all these people who are on welfare but are like super patriotic, and you end up with like, why wouldn't someone do this? You know, just do the work of actually like going to the place and learning about the people and talking to them. It's amazing to me how many people won't even pick up a phone. They just look at what's on Twitter and they go from that.
Yeah, there was a story, I forget who the columnist was. I believe it was somebody at Vox who talked about hating the telephone. And I thought, what journalist admits they hate the telephone, right?
It's how you do your job.
Exactly. I was shocked by that. It was very strange. And then, you know, you talk about not showing up in person. I was just at the hearing.
Yes, I want to ask you about this. Yes. The New Orleans hearing related to... So just give our listeners a little bit of a thumbnail about this case and why you were going down there to watch what would happen.
So this is the Missouri v. Biden internet censorship lawsuit. It has a whole slate of defendants who are being accused of pressuring internet companies into censoring content in violation of the First Amendment. And on July 4th, there was an injunction, or there was an order by the judge in this case, basically barring almost every agency in the government from having contact with social media companies. Now, the Biden administration immediately stayed that order, but if it were to be restored, which is likely what's going to happen in the future, it would be one of the biggest and most influential legal cases we've had probably since the turnover of Roe v. Wade, but it's on the order of that, right? Mm-hmm. And I went to this hearing because there was an oral arguments about whether or not that stay should remain in place, and there were three journalists there. One was from one was from Missouri, one was from Louisiana, because those were the two plaintiff states in the case. No national media. I was the only
one. Oh my god!
Right, and this is, as you point out, there are lots of things that you catch in person that you can't catch from transcripts, from other things. I mean, little details like the fact that the government only sent one lawyer there while the plaintiffs had like, 10, right? That's important. It tells you a lot, right?
And you got to see Don Willett in action.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, right. It was funny.
So the thing, that's a perfect example. They're sending more people to cover women's soccer. They already covered this, you know, and it's like nothing against women's soccer, but it's just like there is more of an investment in covering, you know, things that are actually, you know, very unimportant in the scheme of things versus something like this. The, you know, the ramifications of this case could be enormous. You know, what do you think, what is your feeling having been in the room and observed the interactions between the government lawyers and the judges about where this is headed?
Well, in that particular hearing, it was very clear. This was an appellate court, so it was a 3-judge panel. All 3 judges were very spun up about internet censorship, could not stop pestering the government's lawyer about it. That might not be the case in a different court, although I would think the current Supreme Court would be, pretty favorably disposed to the plaintiffs. I would contrast it to, I once covered a hearing that also involved oral arguments in a drone case, where the government was arguing that it had the right to keep everything about the drone program secret. And you could tell from the questioning that the judges were going to rule in favor of the federal government, that there was not going to be any information released, and that's just the way it was. Here the vibe was opposite. The judges were mad at the government lawyer, or at least gave some indication that they didn't like the position. And also, the government lawyer seemed very halting and not confident in the arguments, which is, you know, as you've covered court cases, right? Like that's a dead.
Yes, giveaway. I actually successfully countersued the government in an NLRB case. So
wow,
yes.
Okay, the
thing that is so important to me that people take away from this is there has to be some kind of ramification for the things that our government has been doing over the past several years when it comes to their censoring of COVID information, when it comes to their censoring of the New York Post, when it comes to any of the different steps that they've been taking interacting with these social media companies. And I fear that we're going to be in a situation where, just like the rest of the media has escaped any kind of ramifications, any kind of judgment, you know, looking at themselves in the mirror over the mistakes that they have made, some intentional, some not, over the past several years, that our government is going to be able to do the same thing and basically get away with everything scot-free, not have anybody even get a slap on the wrist. Is that, do you think, the likeliest, you know, ultimate sort of scenario here? Or do you think that there's something that could be achieved that could actually make sure that this doesn't happen again in the future?
That's a really good question. I think the likelihood that somebody is somehow concretely punished for what happened, that doesn't feel terribly likely to me, although there might be lawsuits where there are consequences, where they're, you know, financially for some of these actors. But I do think that it's very possible that there could be sweeping reforms that would be designed to reinvigorate the First Amendment and give it some presence in this conversation. There have been so many things that have gone on since 9/11 in particular that have really undermined civil liberties and moved a lot of what goes on in America into this secret kind of second governmental system that the public doesn't have access to. I do think that they can do some things to change that, but it's going to take a lot of work and probably a lot of success by the right politicians for that to happen.
Do we need a new ACLU?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Although I think we already have something along that lines in the FIRE. Which what is it, the foundation for
they changed the meaning. They didn't change the acronym, but they changed the words in the acronym. You're looking it up right now.
Foundation for
individual rights.
Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
Expression was eluding me. Yes.
I apologize for not knowing that. I always used to get some of these acronyms confused, but Nico Perino, who's there, mm-hmm. And has really, I think, stepped into the role of the old ACLU. You know, they did a fantastic documentary about Ira Glasser, who was the ACLU head when they defended the right of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. And I think FIRE, although they may be coming at the topic from a slightly more libertarian point of view than the old ACLU did, their basic conception of what civil liberties are and why they need to protect it is almost identical, I think, to what the old ACLU thought. So they're going to step into that role. What happened to the actual ACLU is just mind-boggling, and
it's bonkers.
It's sad to me. I worked with them on so many stories over the years, and this change to me is so disheartening.
I had described myself as like an ACLU conservative back in the 2000s, you know, because I thought of myself as being, you know, very much aligned with their civil libertarian approach. But I can't believe what they've become. It's just very depressing. You, along with someone like Bill Maher, is one of these few people, I think, in media who is viewed as being, you stayed in the same place while the world moved around you. The galaxy rotated, and so you end up in a position where people who are from the right of center are more interested in interviewing you. Is that a weird experience personally? How do you feel about it?
It's a little weird. And you know, there was a time in my life where I probably would have been extremely nervous about it. I didn't give interviews to Fox for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, going back, I think my reasoning on that was a little bit flawed. But even so, you know, I think differently about these things now. Things change. People have, you know, they change their political orientation based on events that take place. And if you are sticking to kind of a principles-based view of the world, where you're looking more at the long view as opposed to the urgent sort of partisan situation in front of you, you're going to end up clashing with people who are your friends. You know, with Donald Trump, I was not a fan of Donald Trump. I'm still not exactly a fan of Donald Trump. I was very critical of him in 2016. But, you know, when things started to happen, like, you know, the raid on his lawyer's office, I remember I got a call from a friend who's like a black drug dealer. And he told me, he's like, if they can do that to him, what are they going to do to my lawyer?
You know? You got a call from your drug dealer.
You can put it that way too.
Yeah. Here's the thing that is so weird to me about it is that, you know, I've been, you know, sort of a libertarian, conservative, populist type, you know, for quite a long time. And I think that, you know, I've been very public in my criticism of Trump, but I also think that there's a point where a system becomes so broken that something comes along, whether it's a person or a movement, that kind of cracks things open for the broader public to see how upset the system is and how wrong it is in so many ways. And I think that he definitely had that effect, which is something that I think of as a positive, because I think unless you have that kind of chemotherapy, you're never going to start to, you know, improve. Sure. But anyway, I with the just with the time that we have left, I have to ask you, you know, is there anyone that you know who's rich enough to just buy Rolling Stone and give it to you?
No, sadly. Although
Elon won't do that for you. It'd be a lot cheaper than Twitter.
Yeah.
No, X. Yes.
Yeah. It would be funny. He did offer, didn't he offer to buy the New York Times the other day?
Yes.
That was funny. I did think that was funny. But
I approve. I don't know what is your opinion of Elon? I'm certain had more interaction with him than the average American.
Well, it got weird at the end with him. You know, I'm not going to lie.
The Substack thing, yeah, very the Substack dumb. Thing. I don't get it. I don't get it. Does this, you know, this is tiny. You don't need to squish it.
Yeah. I think he's sincere about a lot of this stuff. I also think that, you know, like a lot of people who are very, very successful, they can be volcanic and mercurial, and
yeah,
you know, there's not a whole lot you can do
things on a whim.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I personally, as someone who wants crazier billionaires just in general, for the entertainment sake, I'm in favor of what he does, because like I like more billionaires who have like zeppelins and, you know, like, oh, things, yeah, like that, you know?
Yeah. Just like the Twitter files, I mean, to share an anecdote, yeah, that I haven't really told anybody yet, but there was a moment in the first meeting where he's kind of like leaning back in the chair, and there was an executive in the room, and he was saying like, yeah, you know, just grab a desk somewhere and you can look at anything. And the executive's like, do you mean even privileged stuff? And he's like, yeah, you know. And I could see the, you know, everybody in the room like going through various stages of congestive heart failure at the moment. And I was trying not to say anything, but you know, that to do that is you need more rich people who are willing to be nuts a little bit.
Because this, you want to get nuts? Let's get nuts.
Yeah, exactly.
So last question for you. Obviously, are someone who, you know, in addition to being, you know, a great writer and a great reporter, you're also someone who's very, you know, well-read. I'm curious as to sort of what you turn to in your own time for reading in this particularly chaotic moment in American history, to sort of ground yourself or to make sure that you're still, like, staying connected with something outside of this humdrum and ridiculous news cycle. What do you turn to?
Well, Walter and I started doing a thing where we read, you know, short stories every week and talk about that. And the reason for that was just to knock us off the news cycle and get us going back to thinking about things that are real again. So that's really all I haven't been reading a whole lot of new things, but I'll go back and read books that, you know, I haven't for years. Right now I'm going back through The Red and the Black, which is a great book, you know, that everybody...
Al Gore's read. Favorite book, by the way.
Is it really? Oh, no.
Yes, he gave that as an answer to a 2000, like, quiz or something about, like, what his favorite book was.
You just ruined it for me, but it is a great book.
No,
but...
I'm sorry. No, yeah. That shouldn't... It was actually, from my perspective, an expression of how nerdy he actually is that he would say that as his favorite book.
That's, you know, so funny. That's so funny.
Al, why didn't you just say The Firm or something? You
know, like... Right. I'm pretty sure he didn't get the humor in that book. That's an incredibly funny book, among other things. But anyway, anything that's kind of like old and has some depth to it, I go back and read now. And I've got kids, so I try to get introduced into that stuff too. And a lot of poetry. I'm reading a lot more poetry than I used to.
Oh, really? Yeah. Do you have a favorite current or older poet?
I love Archibald MacLeish, Auden, A. Hausman. I mean, I don't know. I like, among other things, I like poems that rhyme, which is, I'm not afraid to say.
If I can recommend A. Stalling's work, if you've not read her, she's an American based in Greece, and she does a lot of stuff that has sort of that influence through things, but it's really, really wonderful. She did her collection Olives, and is very good, and so is a particular favorite if you have kids is Fairy Tale Logic, which you can find.
Awesome.
But anyway,
that
all right, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. Really a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Ben. Take care.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. So I just wanted to give you a brief insight on my perspective on what's going on within the Democratic ranks after the naming of David Weiss to be a special counsel looking into the Hunter Biden affair. Obviously, there's been some great writing done on this from a number of different sources who are typically guests on our show. Andy McCarthy has a good piece at National Review. Jonathan Turley has a good piece about it as well at The Messenger. And I think that, you know, their tendency, which is to sort of say that this is a an attempt to kind of shove everything under the rug, pretend like this is an ongoing investigation and prevent the president from having to answer deep questions about the Hunter Biden affair in lots of different circumstances. And certainly, you know, legally, you know, we'll have to see how these play out. You know, it seems to me that they have the right of it, that basically this is a way to prevent this issue from being one where there is, you know, considerable ability on the part of Congress and of other investigators to dig into it, because it's part of an ongoing investigation involving a special counsel, et cetera, one who already brokered a deal that was viewed as sweetheart by everybody under the sun who isn't a Democrat partisan. But I think there's another way to view this, which is that when you name a special counsel to look into someone, regardless of the outcome of their investigation, that naming in and of itself is a very negative sounding act from the perspective of your average voter. So I do think that to the extent that this is something that is designed to hide the ball internally in DC, it's also something that I think is going to be a negative for the president when he's running for re-election. He's going to continue to get questions about it in every circumstance. He's going to get questions about it on the debate stage eventually, assuming that he and the nominee of the Republican Party do end up debating. We'll see if he tries to dodge that. But the truth is that the president, I think, even if, you know, he was trying to, you know, avoid this, even if his allies were trying to avoid this in terms of this naming of a special counsel who had already shown himself to be very amenable to doing whatever the Biden family wanted him to do, I think that this is something that is a step further in a way that will prove to be a negative politically, and something that will just reinforce the idea that there is something there. Something there to be discovered, something there to be discussed, and something there to be investigated. And that's something that I think, frankly, hurts the current president. It's not something that's going to drive him from office, obviously. It's not something that's going to keep him from running for re-election in all likelihood. But it is something that I think is kind of an indication that Democrats are not happy about what's going on here. And even the allies of the president who, you know, have done their level best to try to play hide the ball on this, are very sick and tired of having to deal with the headache that is Hunter Biden and is all the different new revelations that have come out on a weekly basis, practically, since the president's election. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.